So this morning we're going to be focusing in on Ecclesiastes chapter 8. And as we look at this chapter, we're going to really be looking a little bit at the beginning of the chapter and then at the end of the chapter. And so there's a whole, you know, a whole important section there in the middle that talks about authority and our relationship with authority. And I'd encourage you to read through that. But this morning it's going to be the first couple verses and then the last few verses. And so as we begin, chapter 8 opens up with the questions. Who is like the wise? Who knows the explanation of things? And so I started thinking about these questions. And I started just kind of like, that's kind of normal as I'm thinking about a message and kind of working through things. I kind of let things like that roll around in my mind. And then it was early in the week, I think it was Monday evening, I was, you know, looking through Facebook. And I saw this video clip and I thought, who's like the wise who knows the explanations of things? And then I thought, maybe this kid. And it was impressive.
What's this 12-letter word?
Biographical.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
L-A-C-I-H-P-A-R-G-O-I-B. Biographical.
Correct. What's this 10-letter word?
Mechanical.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
L-A-C-I-M-A-H-C-E-M. Mechanical.
Correct. What's this 7-letter word?
Tempest.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
T-S-E-P-M-E-T. Tempest.
Correct. What's this 14-letter word?
Extinguishable.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
E-L-B-A-H-S-I-U-G-N-I-T-X-E. Extinguishable.
Correct. What's this 15-letter word?
Misappropriated.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
D-E-T-A-I-R-P-O-R-P-P-A-S-I-M. Misappropriated.
Correct. What's this 11-letter word?
Liquidation.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
N-O-I-T-A-D-I-U-Q-I-L. Liquidation.
Correct. What's this 8-letter word?
Zucchini.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
I-N-I-H-C-C-U-C. Zucchini.
Correct. What's this 9-letter word?
Hyperbole.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
E-L-O-B-R-E-P-Y-H. Hyperbole.
Correct. What's this 13-letter word?
Radioactivity.
Correct. Spell it backwards.
Y-T-I-V-I-T-C-A-O-I-D-A-R. Radioactivity.
Correct. What's this 11-letter word?
Yeah.
And so I started watching the clips from all of these kids, some that are like math geniuses and some that are language geniuses. And I thought it was insane and incredible. And then I thought, you know, maybe this is not that I'm smart enough to do this, but some people have that the ability to kind of learn the Rubik's Cube algorithm, if I'm using algorithm correctly. And they're able to kind of flip through that really quick. And I thought maybe this is kind of like one of those like word puzzles. So I watched that clip over and over again, and tried to spell the words backwards and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do more than one or two letters. And I thought, he's a genius. It makes sense why he's on the TV show. And when we encounter people like that, and so he was a genius with his spelling. There were other kids that like, you know, they would do the same thing with a math equation where they're just throwing out more and more equations and it's building, and these kids are responding in seconds before most of us would have the opportunity to kind of even write down what the problem was. They're coming up with the answers just off the top of their heads. And as I was watching these clips, I thought, A, these kids are geniuses. And then I thought, the human mind is incredible. The way that some people are able to process things so quickly, the kind of the intrinsic gifting and the abilities that people have. And some people are born with an ability to be exceptional like that. And other people are still able to develop these incredible areas where they're exceptional and able to just learn and understand things. The gift of intelligence and knowledge is incredible. And the things that we have accomplished as people, the innovations, the way that knowledge and intelligence has shaped us is also incredible. Throughout history, there have been these huge shifts in the way that people, in groups of people, have viewed the world. And one of those shifts happened at the kind of the late 17th century and the early 18th century. Kind of, it was in Europe, and with the end of the Renaissance and kind of the beginning of the Enlightenment, it ushered in this era that has been known for several hundred years as modernity. And really, this era, which philosophers kind of disagree on. Some people say we're still kind of right in the heart of modernity. Some people say it's kind of like just fading into postmodernity. And other people would say for a few decades, we've sort of been out of the modern era. But throughout modernity, for hundreds of years, there was this emphasis on the intelligence that humans could acquire, on the innovations that humans could create through their intelligence, on the ways that people could shape the world around them. In this age, it was filled with people. Some people that were geniuses, like the people we watched, that were able to foster in some of these incredible innovations. Some people that sort of stumbled onto innovations and advancements in whether it's science or technology or medicine that have vastly improved our lives. Some people who worked at it really hard and made advancements. And at the end of the day, modernity's been able to produce so much good in the world around us. It's changed the way that people live and the way that people will always live by improving the human condition. And so if we think about even our morning routines in this room, it has been shaped by modernity and by the Enlightenment and by the experiments that have taken place over the last several hundred years. I mean, people lived in homes before modernity, but last night many of us slept on a mattress instead of a sack that was stuffed with wheat or grass. And when we slept on that mattress for us, it wasn't just like an accidental mattress. It was a mattress that went through all kinds of testing. It was a mattress that was shaped by research from people about the best materials, about the way to position springs, about the way to help our backs, to be more comfortable, the way to improve our posture, the way to help us rest better and sleep better. Many of us woke up on a mattress like that, even if it's old and lumpy now. When it was designed, that's the way that it was formed. Many of you also probably woke up in some kind of a temperature-controlled room, whether it was air conditioning or a window air conditioning unit or a fan at least that was blowing on you. Those are all experiences of human innovation that we benefit from. If you used the toilet and had indoor plumbing, incredible human innovation that we haven't always experienced. If you brushed your teeth, you probably used a toothbrush that was ADA approved, which means that either they paid for the approval or that it was shaped by rigorous scientific testing to see what kind of materials and formations they could use as they positioned the bristles on the brush and the tongue scraper on the other side to get rid of your morning breath and your plaque. If you showered and had warm water, that's innovation. One of the most important technological innovations of all time is whatever device you use to brew your coffee this morning. And then, after going through all of this routine and getting dressed and prepared for church, most of us, I wasn't included in this, but most of us got into a car that had a combustion engine inside of it that used gasoline and that propelled you here, which is something that in the pre-modern era would have appeared like an otherworldly miracle to the people if they could come and see that today. There's essentially no end to the way that the Enlightenment and modernity have influenced our lives. As science and technology began to advance rapidly and humans went through the scientific revolution and the industrial revolution and, the democratic revolutions that took place and maybe our most recent kind of technology revolution that has been happening in our world, what we began to develop was this mindset that when we encounter problems in life, we can fix those things. And that mindset has carried over into most aspects of our life. It's affected the way we view our health, our food, our jobs, our relationships, our spirituality, our politics, all of it kind of shaped by modernity. And the good things that came from that are vast. It has ushered in an age of development for humans. But the belief of modernity was that it wouldn't just improve our lives, but that we as people could use our minds and our intellect and reason and innovation to usher in human flourishing. It's kind of developed this belief that many of us have, that if we have a health problem, we should be able to go to see a physician and they should give us a magic pill or have a procedure that can fix it immediately. If we have a food problem, we, you know, kind of genetically modify our foods. We make them bug resistant. We make them more fruitful. We make them larger. We take livestock and we give it all kinds of pills and steroids and things like that to make it bigger, faster, so that we can meet the demand that we have. If we have disagreements with people, we've kind of established this position in our culture, in modernity, where rational thought and science is what we can empirically prove is what determines what is correct. And so we approach arguments in that kind of way, almost like we're in court, always kind of pleading our case to provide the evidence that we're right, that we can solve anything. The underpinning belief was that the human mind is not just this incredible gift, that people like that kid who can spell words backwards, that it isn't just something that a few people are gifted with, but that as people, our minds are able to alleviate human suffering. Words like innovation kind of became synonymous with words like improvement. Efficiency kind of became something that was viewed as intrinsically better than something that took a long time to produce. And really, ultimately, the human mind became the key. What we could foster becomes the key to fixing the problems of life. But there was a problem with modernity. That's been revealed, and this isn't anything new. The problem was that it points to the conditions of the world as these problems to be rectified by people and for people. Modernity says, look, there are all of these things, harsh climates, food problems, health illnesses, you know, all of these things outside and external to us that are problems, and we have the ability to fix those problems ourselves and for ourselves. And many people would say, and there have been a few kind of milestones along this path, but many people would point to the horrific events of World War II as the moment when kind of the modern worldview began to crumble. It was the moment when the world kind of picked up madness and began to engage in this huge conflict with one another, and the loss of life and the casualties that took place. What they revealed to the world was that there had been all of this technological advancement that had taken place in weaponry and our ability to kill one another and our ability to kind of destroy life. And it ultimately ended when the war ended, with the atomic bombs dropping, and then some people woke up to have this realization that the human mind, that intellect, it has the ability to solve lots of problems, and at the same time, our technological innovations led us to a place where we could literally destroy human life, where we could cause the entire planet to become extinct through technological innovations that took place. And what people began to kind of become awakened to was this reality that perhaps the problem wasn't just the conditions that we find ourselves in life that we need to come up with answers for. Maybe the problem was people. And so knowledge and wisdom are wonderful things. They improve our lives in vast and in innumerable ways. And Solomon affirms this in the next part of verse 1 in chapter 8. He says this: a person's wisdom brightens their face and changes its hard appearance. He advocates wisdom is good. Wisdom puts things into perspective for us. Wisdom helps us to see this big picture in life. It enables us to be like the people we talked about last week, people that aren't kind of downtrodden and rocked back and forth by every problem and every circumstance we experience in life, because we're able to kind of step back and have this big picture of life. It helps us to be people that when someone's driving, you know, 40 in a 45, that we don't lose our minds in anger behind them. when we're late. It helps us to be people that when we just finished waxing our car and then a bird with a full bladder flies over it and does its thing, that we don't have to lose our minds. Because when we live in wisdom, we live with this big perspective in life. That there are some things that are big and important things in life, and there are other things that at the end of our lives aren't going to matter at all. When we live with the end in sight, big things matter and little things don't bother us in the same kind of way. Wisdom, as a result, what Solomon talks about, or a right way of thinking, of viewing life, helps to soften our hard appearance, because things that matter stick, and things that get us all worked up that don't matter kind of melt away. They kind of fade away into the background. And while there are differences in wisdom and knowledge, oftentimes in Ecclesiastes and other wisdom books, you see the terms used almost interchangeably, where wisdom and knowledge, kind of this great mind and understanding, are used the same way. And it's appropriate for us to say that knowledge, in the same way, it brightens our faces and changes our hard appearances. It's a good thing that we slept on mattresses and that most of us didn't sleep on a straw sack. It's a good thing that we've had all of these kinds of innovations in technology and health and so many of the different facets of life, where there's been innovation and our lives have changed. It's good for us to be people who have advanced in knowledge and wisdom throughout life. So Solomon extols these things to the people. He talks about how they're positive. And he asks, who possesses them? And then at the end of the chapter, he dives in to suggest how we should live under the sun and how we should view wisdom. And he says this beginning in verse 16. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe the labor that is done on earth, people getting no sleep day or night, then I saw all that God has done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend. And there's a lot that we can say about this admission from Solomon. But really, what this does is it refocuses the big story of Ecclesiastes back on this pursuit for the meaning of life. And in these verses, Solomon says, look, I've thought deeply about life. I've looked at the way that people live and at the lives that people experienced. I've really kind of... He demonstrated this so often. He's excelled in wisdom and knowledge and intelligence. He's known as the wisest human in existence. And yet, the wisdom and knowledge that he's gained, the things that he's observed, they still have not allowed him to grasp ultimate meaning and to really understand life. When he says, even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it, he's saying, even myself, the wisest person who's ever lived, I can't comprehend what's going on in the world around me. And so last week we spoke about how ignorance really isn't that blissful to us. How ignorance doesn't really provide us bliss. And that keeping the end of life is important to living well now. And in this chapter, Solomon teaches us that while ignorance isn't bliss, that knowledge and wisdom helps to soften our hard appearances. It helps to improve our lives. That at the end of the day, wisdom can never be fully satisfying, because as people, we have a stronger curiosity to know than we have a capacity to understand. That as people, we're asking questions in our lives that we just can't come to the bottom of. That we just can't come to a neat conclusion to. And so, there are a few things this text teaches us as a result. The first is this. That our lack of knowledge and wisdom should lead us to a place of humility. And when I first was kind of, you know, shaping this message and some points of application, I typed up this sentence and I said, our lack of knowledge and wisdom leads us to a place of humility. And then I stepped back and I thought, maybe that's not really that true. Maybe for lots of us, when we experience a circumstance where we don't have the wisdom that we desire, where we don't have the knowledge that we desire, where we have kind of these big questions, they're things that should lead us to a place of humility, but oftentimes they can lead us to a place of questioning and ultimately sort of to a place of hopelessness. When some people realize that the universe is vast beyond our understanding, that things happen in life without explanation, that bad things happen to good people, that seemingly random things happen, whether good or bad, and we look for answers for them and we can't get them. When we realize that we don't have the ability to manufacture utopia and this perfect state of human flourishing, lots of people begin to approach God with a sense of skepticism and hopelessness. At first, you kind of maybe doubt the goodness of God. And then lots of people kind of move from this position where they're doubting the goodness of God to doubting his omnipotence and his sovereignty. They say maybe God really isn't all powerful. Maybe he doesn't have the ability to change things. Maybe this is all kind of a farce. It kind of leads you from this place of questioning God's goodness, to questioning God's ability, to questioning God's existence. When we realize that there are things that are unknowable about our world, about God, and about ourselves, it is something that causes us kind of naturally, for many of us, to sort of wrestle with God. And while it's not bad to have big questions or to dig into figuring out the answers to those questions, for some people, those problems in life lead us to a place of doubt instead of a place of humility. And this is kind of what we see when we look to another wisdom book. When we look at the book of Job and the story of Job, we see this kind of exact scenario play out. And we're going to read from Job a little bit if you'd like to turn there. And this is kind of the scenario that we see play out in Job. When Job opens up, we see the story of a man who was good, a man who was righteous, a man who lived his life in a way that sought to honor God, to lead his family well in honoring God, even to seek to kind of atone for the sins of his children. And in a short period of time, Satan is given permission to test the faithfulness of Job by wreaking havoc and catastrophe on his wealth, on his family, on his property, and eventually even on his health. And in the midst of Job's struggles in life, he is wildly confused about what's taking place. Much of the story of the book of Job is him trying to kind of just get his bearings straight and to figure out what happened and why he's being subject to this, what he thinks of is this punishment from God. And so he goes through these moments where he has several friends and even his wife who are saying to him, Job, you need to kind of identify, how is it that you've sinned against God? And they keep kind of probing him and asking him these questions. And they say, look, you must have done committed some kind of heinous act. You must have sinned in some kind of way that you're being punished for this. Job's wife comes to him at one point, and this is literally, Job is sitting on the ash heap of his life, covered in sores, and it says that he's scraping them with pieces of broken pottery. And his friends and his family and his wife, his wife comes to him and says basically, you are cursed. There's no other way to understand this, and so it would be better for you to curse God and die. And Job wrestles, and he doesn't accept kind of some of those things that his friends are offering, and he says, this isn't right. I don't know why God is doing this to me. I can't come up with this answer. And then this scene begins to play out in the story where Job kind of, what he desires, what he says he wants really, is sort of his day in court. To appear before God and to say, what is going on? Why am I being subjected to this kind of treatment? And in Job chapter 31, Verses 35 to 37, Job concludes this desire to appear before God, and he says this: "Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing. Surely I would wear it on my shoulder. I would put it on like a crown. I would give him an account of my every step. I would present it to him as to a ruler." Job's lack of knowledge and understanding of the situation that he was in, it never led him, in the midst of hardship, to question maybe the sovereignty of God, the ability of God. It never led him to question the strength of God. But it led him to this place where there were questions he couldn't find an answer to. And instead of responding in humility, he's levying accusations against God. And so as the story develops, there's one more person who speaks, and they speak to Job with godly wisdom. And it doesn't just say then that God responds to Job, but it says that God responds to Job in a storm. So if we try to imagine the setting of the passage we're going to read next, Job is a man who has had his life torn apart, who has had his children taken from him, who's had his health taken from him, who's had his wealth and ability taken from him in a very short span of time. He says he's righteous and he questions God. And this is how God answers him in a storm. In Job chapter 38, verse 2, God responds in saying, "Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set, or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy." And I'll say this: when Yahweh speaks through a storm and says, "Brace yourself like a man," you know you have not responded properly to the lack of knowledge that you possess. And what follows is God going through all of the different ways where there's a great disparity in knowledge between what God knows and what Job even has the ability as a human to be able to understand. And at one point in Job chapter 40, Job kind of, he raises a white flag in a sense. And he says, "Look, I spoke, but I will speak no more. Like, I agree, I questioned you, I was foolish, I shouldn't have done that, my mouth will remain shut." And God goes on for another two chapters, and then, when Job has a chance to reply in Job 42, beginning in verse 2, he says this: "I know that you can do all things, no purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, 'Who is this that obscures my plans without knowledge?' Surely, I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, 'Listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes.'" It doesn't come immediately for Job, but he learns the hard way that when his lack of knowledge is revealed, it doesn't mean that he has the ability to comprehend the things he's looking for, and that it's better for him to respond in humility. Another thing we learn from this passage and from both Ecclesiastes and the story in Job is that our lack of knowledge and wisdom should lead us to a place of dependency. In the same way that our limitations should lead us to a position of humility, it should reaffirm for us this understanding that we need to live in a way that is dependent upon our Creator. As we see so many unanswerable elements of sort of the nature of our existence, we should take comfort in what we read in the book of Job, that at the beginning of creation, that God was there, that He was the one who's laid the foundations for the earth where we live, that he is the one who holds the answers to questions that are, and knowledge that is more wonderful than our human minds are able to comprehend, that he is the one who ultimately holds the meaning of life. When we realize how little we know, it should lead us to a place of dependency instead of a place of anxiety. It should lead us to a place where we recognize that we need to depend on God, than where we work and we try so hard, anxiously, to be able to control creation around us. So some of the most prominent shapers of the Enlightenment and of modernity, they had this belief, they were firmly tied, really, to this idea, to this conviction, that as human knowledge and innovation increased, that it would mean that spirituality and religion would become unimportant. That it would mean that that an understanding of God wouldn't matter because we were able to solve the problem of human suffering on our own. And we can look, in a sense, to the decline of religion in Western culture in many facets and see that the modern thinkers hundreds of years ago weren't necessarily wrong in some of that prediction about what would take place. But after hundreds and hundreds of years, and after, again, innumerable advancements in technology, innumerable advancements in improving our lives, at the end of the day, we would have to recognize that we aren't a whole lot closer to fixing human suffering now than we were then. That oftentimes our advancements in technology and innovation have alleviated some problems, but created other significant problems for us. That what we used to hail as innovations, even in our recent past, we would now question and say, was this a good decision for us, a decision made in wisdom or not? What we see is that when we lack knowledge, it should lead us to a place of humility and a place of dependency. And finally, our lack of knowledge and wisdom should lead us to Christ. The end of Ecclesiastes chapter 8, it points out in humility, that as humans, we can't know all of the answers. It points out kind of the fault of the modern mindset, that even if we can improve life, even if we can gain knowledge, even if we're wise in so many ways, we will never be able to be smart enough to solve all of the problems that we encounter or to answer all of the questions that we have in life. And this is ultimately something that should point us to Christ. Paul teaches us this in the book of Colossians. And to give a little context, one of the interesting things about religion in general, and this has kind of been true of the Christian church from the very beginning, is that as humans, we're more comfortable with rules and things that we need to do than without having rules or guidelines. And so it was common, even in the early church, like we would see in lots of churches today, it was common for people to say, hey, you need to believe in Jesus, but you also need to follow rules X, Y, and Z for you to really be a part of the club, a part of the group. It's you need to believe in Jesus, but if you're going to be a righteous person, you also need to do this or that or something else. And that's not what Jesus taught, but that's something that humans have oftentimes introduced into church life throughout existence. And this is something that was happening in the church in Colossae. And so in this church, what was taking place is that people were worshiping Jesus and they were saying, there's also this kind of secret knowledge that you need to be able to understand. And to do that, you need to worship angels and you need to follow through with some special religious practices that will help you to kind of gain this secret knowledge. And Paul writes this letter to kind of categorically smack that down as quickly and as authoritatively as he's able to say, no, we as Christians live and recognize the sufficiency of Jesus to meet all of the needs that we have. And in chapter 2, we're just going to read one verse. In chapter 2 in Colossians, there is this point where Paul is talking about Jesus and explaining this, and he refers to him at the end of verse 2 and then verse 3 by saying, Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And as Paul was writing this, what he was saying was that, you know, this is kind of harking back to the wisdom literature that was designed to instruct people in how to live so that they could walk in wisdom and knowledge. And Paul is saying, look, you don't have to fulfill all of these extra requirements that you're adding on to the Christian faith. You need to recognize that Jesus is the source of all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And he's not saying there's some kind of secret that we have to unlock in Jesus. Matthew Henry, in his famous commentary, spoke of this passage and said, "The treasures of wisdom are not hidden from us, but for us in Christ." The passage isn't talking about secret knowledge hidden from us. It's saying that the key to living a life of wisdom and knowledge is to live in Jesus. That Jesus is the person who is sufficient to meet all of our needs. That we have this view that we can sometimes extend our knowledge and wisdom to alleviate suffering, but that we need to be people that depend on Christ for our wisdom and knowledge. That when we come to those moments in life where we're sort of at the end of our chain, where we have questions that we need answers, that we feel like we need answers to and we can't find, where something happens and we begin asking God, why would you allow this to happen to us? We need to be people that recognize that we have sufficiency in Christ for all of the answers and to meet all of the needs that we have in life. And so I just want to close with a few questions. When you're in a place where you feel a lack of knowledge, whether that's the bottom falling out in life where things seem random or unfair or unjust or unexplainable, when you're in a place like that, does it lead you to a place of humility? Or does it lead you to a place of frustration? When we're in a place like that, does it lead you to a place of dependency? Or does it lead you to a place of anxiety and doubt? When we're in that kind of a place, ultimately, where there are answers that we need and we don't feel like we can get them, is it something that draws you closer to Christ and that leads you to Him? Or draws you closer to hopelessness and doubt and maybe the belief that you can't find those answers that you're looking for? As we close this morning, we're going to lift up the name of Christ together. As we take this time to worship and to recognize Christ, I would encourage you to think through the way you live when you encounter things in life that you can't explain. Are they things that draw you closer to God or that move you further away from Him? And to recognize, even as we sing, that we have a Savior whose name we can praise in Christ.